Dr. Fred Harvey, internist, gerontologist, member of the American Board of Holistic Physicians, and like myself, a graduate of applied clinical practice functional medicine training from the Institute for Functional Medicine. You know, Dr. Harvey is usually here on the third Monday of every month, but because of the Thanksgiving holiday, and apologize for that screw-up with my show last week, but that's what it is when you're dealing with amateur radio. Dr. Harvey joins me to give another perspective, because I have to tell you, this last week, I really had a situation where my brain lit up when I realized that our Do Nothing Congress actually did something. And what they did was to hurt our children. And I say our children collectively, because it doesn't matter whether it's my kids, Dr. Harvey's kids, or your kids. What's true is all kids are our kids. And you want to remember that even if you're one of those people who doesn't have children and doesn't care one whit about school lunch rules, what's true is that we're raising the generation that's going to end up taking care of you. We're raising the generation that we're ultimately going to vote into office, as frightening as that is. So it would be nice to say that it's simply shocking when 5 days after the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute recommended that children between 9 and 11 get tested for high cholesterol, that Congress blocked the landmark changes, the first changes that would have happened in 15 years to the school lunch program. But it really is no shock at all, because what the Congress is essentially doing is condemning children to shortened lives, diseased lifetimes, and nobody seems willing to act. Not Congress, not the marketers, not even the parents. And so I'm alarmed. I'm alarmed because what's been in our headlines for the last 10 months has been nothing but the debt ceiling, got to get rid of the debt ceiling crisis, got to lower the national debt. And when we realize that the single biggest expense on the national debt, after buying bombs to kill people and buying other equipment to maim and plunder and do all of the other things that the military-industrial complex bequeaths on populations around the world, our next biggest expense is healthcare. And so if you really wanted to do something to reduce healthcare, you'd start with little kids. So we would try to give guidance, direction, and choices that would help children not end up obese, diabetic, with heart disease, etc. You know, obesity is a complex condition. It's a combination of inactivity and genetics and socioeconomic status and peer pressure and cultural consumption. And a term that I've never actually used before in a sentence, but it's called nutritional incomprehension. Now, stop right there. Nutritional incomprehension. They just don't understand what's good for them. Well, I'm here to tell you, you don't need a PhD in nutrition to tell a Pringle from a potato. You don't need a background in health and medical application to be able to tell the difference between a chicken and a chicken nugget. And so there are places that our guidance when it comes to children's health are really very misplaced. So whether you have kids or not, I think that this no-nonsense nutrition show is going to be important for you to hear, because you've got neighbors that are kids, and you've got grandbabies, and you've got nieces and nephews, and you've got other gatherings where we're around children. And so, Dr. Harvey, I'd like to explore this issue about apathy when it comes to children's health. The apathy that's been shown not only by manufacturers, but by Congress itself, as far as kids' health is concerned. I'm alarmed. Are you?
Terribly alarmed. I think Congress deserves the single-digit approval rating that it has currently achieved. They're absolutely beyond a do-nothing Congress. They are a do-damage Congress.
Uh-oh.
And they're just not working in anyone's best interest, except for the interest of the billionaires who own the corporations that foist these terrible food products on, or food-like substances on our children.
Well, and food-like substances, let's start right there. You know, I did a class a couple of Saturdays ago, and the ladies that I work with in the clinic had gone out and gotten a sandwich at lunch from one of the Gulf Gate joints. Mm-hmm. You know, down our way.
Yes.
And they had come back with a bag of cheddar bacon flavored chips that the outfit gave with the sandwich.
Right.
And I used that bag as an example during my class because it had 32 ingredients in it.
For potato chips.
For potato chips. 16 of which were hard to pronounce.
No doubt.
And I've got a biochemistry background. Mm-hmm. And so the, you know, what becomes hard about looking at something that's got, you know, 32 ingredients in it and it's supposed to just be, you know, fried pieces of potato?
Right.
You'd think it would be potato and oil and salt, maybe three ingredients.
Yes.
But 32 ingredients to make bacon and cheddar flavored chips.
And there's likely to be no bacon in that.
Right. Or cheddar. And possibly no potatoes. But the idea being that this is an edible, consumable good, but is it a food?
It's not a food. Food comes from the earth, and this thing came from some factory that processed it and overprocessed it and reprocessed it and then sprayed petrochem over it to make it taste like something that it wasn't.
Well, you know, when I look at people that are trying to make a difference, you know, the CEO of Pepsi-Cola really came under fire by her board because she was trying to promote healthy food products, and they were actually undermining the core products of Pepsi. And so, you know, her statement that sodas and Doritos and Lay's chips are all fine as long as they're consumed in moderation. So is that what children are doing, is consuming these non-food edibles in moderation?
You've got to be kidding. tater tots are the principal food, or the principal, quotes, vegetable source for kids in schools. Fried potatoes are 46% of kids age 6 to 19 consumption.
So
of vegetables.
For vegetables, it's French fries, fried potatoes, hash browns, tater tots, all of the varieties of that. And that's the reason that the potato lobby won out. When the USDA recommended that we limited the serving of starchy foods to 2 times a week, they made the exception of potatoes. So potatoes will still be available in any amounts in school lunches from this point forward.
It's a cheap way to fill up a belly poorly. Truly, it's not really good nutrition, obviously. Deep-fried, fat-fried, trans-fat-fried chunks of processed potato that are very high in salt are causing obesity, hypertension, high cholesterol, and so many other health problems for our children.
So the real question is, what are the ways that fast food hurts kids? Well, the first way is the fat content. Fast food typically contains large amounts of fat, especially saturated and trans fat, which are not healthy for anyone. And according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, your child's daily fat consumption should amount to about a third of their calories. Well, I have yet to have a parent walk in my door who knows how many calories are in virtually anything except a snack pack.
Yeah, so, it's because they're labeled 100-calorie snack pack.
Right. But, you know, the heart-healthy, unsaturated kinds of fats are the ones that we should be giving kids. It's a danger to consume too much fat regularly, especially things like trans fats. So, doctor, why are trans fats bad for us?
Well, trans fats are unlike fats that occur in nature. They're not like the fats that are in our bodies. So they create situations of stress, toxic stress on the system. They damage the walls of the arteries. They clog up the liver. They make the brain less functional. And they appear to have enough inflammatory influence to cause degenerative diseases like cancer and diabetes and arthritis and Alzheimer's disease.
And so when we look at trans fats, anytime you look on a label and you see the word hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated oils, doesn't make any difference whether it's in your pudding mix or your mayonnaise or your french fries. Every time you see hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils, run!
They are toxic even in the smallest amounts.
And so what they did on the labeling efforts, changes that were made a few years ago, is if there was less than half a gram of hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated oils, they didn't have to put them on the label.
They could actually even advertise 0 grams trans fat.
Even though there was trans fats in there. And so when we say, you know, this moderation theme, oh, well, it's okay if your kids eat it now and then. You've raised 2 children. You know what it's like when a kid becomes demanding to, you know, drive into the Golden Arches or when any of the other fast food joints and pick up something. Do they stop at french fries alone?
Almost never. Got to have that 16-ounce sugar slurpy thing.
Sugar bomb.
You know, I just was thinking about that. I watched the movie last night, or a show from PBS called Blue Gold, where water is becoming commoditized and being sold like gold on the market. And they were comparing in Ghana or one of the African countries, Coke in glass bottles versus Dasani water in plastic bottles. And this African manager for Coke was saying how the It's more expensive to ship glass, so the Coke costs more. He was completely lying. The Coke cost half as much as the water. And this is the only water source, because Coke had taken up all the water sources in that country and they had nothing but bottled water. So they had to pay like $1 for a bottle of water versus 50 cents for the same size bottle of Coke. So people were drinking polluted water called Coke instead of drinking pure water because it cost half as much.
Right. When you see the movie FLOW, Flow, For the Love of Water, and you see the number of places in the world where water is becoming a commodity because people are owning the rights to it, it's enough to make you want to take up arms.
Yes, it's horrible, and people are taking up arms about it.
But let's come back to school lunches now. You know,
I wanted to talk about that, because after that, this little boy actually saw that they were doing it in his school, and he made a poster campaign. An 8-year-old made a poster campaign that took the poster to the school board and to the state, actually, and he got the bottled water banned out of his school, and he started going as an activist to local groceries and saying, "You got to get rid of this bottled water, it's killing us."
We love these kids. But that's, you know, that's a kid that's been fed well and his brain is working right. You know, we have to understand that building a baby's brain, building an infant and a toddler's brain, starts with the first breath.
That's right.
And so actually it starts in utero, but we'll make that another program. The idea of a child laying down 250,000 brain cells an hour is something that's virtually beyond comprehension. You know, we can't conceptualize that a baby would be making 250,000 brain cells an hour and then another 250,000 brain cells the next hour. Then those brain cells are being built primarily with the kind of fats that are in the diet. And so if we put funky fats into the diet of these toddlers and young children, we end up not only increasing their risk for diabetes and obesity, we end up increasing their risk of heart disease and stupidity.
Exactly.
We literally get a brain that doesn't work as well when it's built out of fats that are unlike the way the fats are in the body. You know, when I looked at the worst picked list of from the truth about fast foods, bodybuilding.com has done a really good job about making this list called the truth about fast foods, because what they did is they took all of the top fast food restaurants and they listed their top 3 picks and then they listed their worst pick. And so, you know, we can get a bacon ultimate cheeseburger with 77 grams of fat and almost 1,100 calories in a single burger. And now we've got a child being served a portion that is much larger than that child should ever eat.
Right. That's the whole daily intake.
But what do you grow up with? You grow up with finish your plate, you know.
Yes.
Clean your plate. And so one of the things that I see that kids that are impressed on kids is to do that. And as a result, kids can end up eating way more food than they actually should. Because by the time they go into, you know, the local sub shop and get a 6-inch meatball sub, they've got 24 grams of fat. And the bacon ultimate cheeseburger at 77 starts, you know, looking really bad against 24, but even 24 grams of fat is not a good idea. I was surprised even at the famous chicken place that you could get a chunky chicken pot pie with 48 grams of fat in it.
Wow.
So over and over again, as I look on the best picks and the worst picks list, the mind blower of all of them is the 77 gram of fat bacon ultimate cheeseburger.
It'd actually be healthier just to take out the tub of butter and have a couple of spoonfuls.
Well, and the thing is that bacon is somehow becoming a rock star right now.
Yes.
I was looking through a Christmas catalog last night, and now you can get bacon earrings, and they had a bacon rug, and they had a bacon bedspread, and they had all sorts of things bacon, and they had a cookbook, a bacon cookbook. And
can you imagine sleeping under a slab of bacon?
Well, the idea being that people idolized this enough that they were making copycat foods of it. So what children eat does project their future health. And when we look at obesity and overweight in this country, and we realize that one third of all school children are either obese or overweight, we're looking at creating a population of diabetics. If you want to see the debt ceiling rise, if you want to see health costs go up, start looking at individuals who are entering the healthcare system at age 12 and 20 instead of entering the healthcare system at age 65 and 75.
Yes, a 10-year-old with hypertension and high cholesterol is a crime. That's, as far as I'm concerned, it's child abuse. Unfortunately, the parents aren't educated any better either because they've been indoctrinated by 50 years of consumer-oriented advertising that make it seem like it's really okay to eat the Golden Arches stuff.
Well, but you see, that started with my mother. I can remember how excited my mother was when macaroni and cheese in a box came out.
Yes.
Because it was a convenience food.
Convenient.
I can remember sitting down with the TV tray of the Swanson's chicken dinner, TV dinner, and as a kid thinking that that was fabulous.
Oh, I did
that
too.
You got it with the little sections and the aluminum foil.
That Saturday was night when my parents went out for dinner, I got a TV dinner and whatever, like Star Trek or whatever show was on TV that night. It was a treat.
And the other one I remember that my mother was in love with was the cake mix that the pan came in the box.
Oh, yeah.
And so when you open the box, the pan came out and you mixed it right in the pan and you stuck it in the oven. And, you know, the idea that women were enslaved in the kitchen and they were going to become free of these terrible duties of the kitchen created the first generation of women who didn't cook.
Right.
And so then, needless to say, they didn't teach their daughters to cook. I've told this story on the air before, but I repeat it for point here. I had a 30-year-old mother that had three children under 10 years old come in to my clinic. And she worked for a bank, and she made $80,000 a year. She had a master's degree. And when I did her consult, I suggested to her as one of the things that she needed to do was to add onions to her diet. And she had kind of a quizzical look on her face and asked me if she could use the dehydrated onions in the jar. And I said, no, the particular property that I needed her to get in her diet from the onions would come from fresh onions. And she had sort of a sheepish look on her face and then explained to me that she didn't know which part of the onion to save and which part of the onion to throw away. So here was a 30-year-old woman with a master's degree who didn't know what part of an onion that you ate because she had never sliced an onion.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Well, you know, for me, where an onion a day keeps the doctor away.
Yes.
Present company excluded.
Well, I get my onion a day, so we'll be together for a while.
So the nature of the onion a day is because onions got so many great properties in it. You know, start out with the sulfur content, you know, go right from there to a natural tranquilizer, you know, go right.
Quercetin.
Yeah, you can go on and on. But the thing was that it would be hard for me to teach this woman how to feed her kids well when she had no idea how to cook.
Or then again, I think obviously the corollary is how to eat well herself.
So if we're going to combat the rise in childhood obesity, we need to look back 2 years, because in 2009 is when the Federal Trade Commission and three other government agencies were asked to create voluntary nutritional standards for foods that are marketed to children. And so there was some public comment, but the FTC said, oh, well, we're going to have to modify these guidelines. So the nature of the lobbyists from the food industry, who spend about $2 billion a year on advertising and marketing to children directly, tried to squash the voluntary standards. So even though the standards wouldn't be enforceable, they still tried to squash them. So they were outlining limits on unhealthful ingredients like added sugars and trans fats and sodium, and they were trying to increase nutritious ingredients like whole grains and low-fat dairy products. And they were specifically looking from the Federal Trade Commission at limiting advertising to children age 2 to 17 that was advertising on things that make up a big part of children's diets, like carbonated beverages and candy and snack foods and sugary cereals and fast food. The FTC now says those guidelines shouldn't apply to ads directed at adolescents 12 through 17, only kids 2 through 12. And by the way, it doesn't cover seasonal candies. You can still do all the advertising you want for Christmas candy, Valentine candy, Halloween candy, Easter candy, etc. Now, a few companies like Mars and Hershey have limited commercials for candy to very young children, but these unhealthy foods account for 86% of all the food ads on television and on the web last year. So the lobbyists have had their way. They have not only avoided the changes to the school lunch program, they've also avoided having to change the way that they advertise to children. And remember, the things in the school lunch program were really simple things like adding more whole grains. The thing is that in the legislature, and I did read the entire bill, it is a cure for insomnia, if any of you are trying to solve that problem. What was actually true was that they established a whole grain requirement, but they didn't define whole grain.
That's a very interesting problem.
There was supposed to be a sodium reduction target that was going to take place over the next 10 years, and they've decided that's too fast.
10 years.
And remember, we credited
I guess the question is, why would that be too fast?
Well, this was the whole conclusion, was that they were afraid that children were going to reject the food.
Tough. I raised two children, and if they rejected the food, they didn't eat. I put the plate back in the fridge, and when they came out and said, Daddy, I'm hungry, I said, okay, you didn't have even one bite off that plate. First, you must have one bite of each food. And they learned to eat everything. My kids are great omnivores, and that's all we need. Solid, strong-backed parents who are willing to say no. Because no is one of the best things you can say to a child.
Well, and you know what I tell parents all the time in my practice is you can't choose what food a child will eat.
That's true.
But you can choose what they choose from.
That's very true.
So you can't pick the food your kid will eat, but you can pick what they choose from. And so if you're putting out fresh food, real fruit, real vegetables, not fruit juice and not tater tots. You know, when we look at fruit juice and fried potatoes, they make up the majority of the fruits and vegetables that most children eat. So when they say, oh yeah, kids are eating 2.5 cups of fruits and vegetables over the course of the week, what they're saying is they're eating 2.5 cups of french fries and fruit juice, not fruits and vegetables. And so,
Here's something about that apple juice too. On the show I watched yesterday, Blue Gold, it takes 14,000 liters, I think, of water to get 1 liter of apple juice, We're wasting water creating apple juice for a beverage. We should be eating the apples. And the other thing is 99% or 90% of the apple juice that's consumed in America today is produced in China. It's very scary to think about all our kids drinking melamine-induced apple juice.
Well, when we look at the stuff that made the front page, you know, what made the front page was the echo of the Reagan years when Reagan tried to save money and declare ketchup a vegetable.
Right.
Now what we've done is we've declared tomato paste a vegetable. And so, you know, the issue with the school lunches wasn't a matter of money. It was going to increase the cost of school lunches about 14 cents over a period of several years.
Yes.
It was about this issue of the fact that the kids would not accept it because it would change the products in such a way to make them unpalatable to students.
Well, yeah, they're going to require a half a cup of tomato paste to be considered a vegetable, which is about the serving that you'd need to consider it a vegetable, but they dropped it to 2 tablespoons.
Well, ConAgra Foods, which lobbies, you know, tremendously for their frozen pizza business, French fry maker McCain Foods, and others say they don't want to make something that's unpalatable to students. So, see, they're only looking out for the child's welfare.
Yes, that's so true.
All right. So, does that sound like a concern for kids' health at a time when childhood obesity has become a national crisis?
It's completely irrelevant.
Even without a mandate from Congress, school districts can put healthier foods on the menu. And so there are places where that action is actually being done. What was a complete surprise to me was finding out that in Texas, they now have cameras. And the cameras are tied to the payment of the kids' lunch. And they actually send an email home to show the parents what the kid is spending the money on. So they
That's
get a picture of the tray and send it home. And those, they're called calorie cameras. Those calorie cameras are scheduled to be put into some schools in Maryland as well. And so at least the parents are going to be knowing what the kids are eating in school, because otherwise you don't know.
But like the 30-year-old that came to your office, if she looks at that tray, it's going to mean nothing to her because she's got nutritional incomprehension.
Exactly. So where are we going to start with all of this? Well, the first thing that we have to realize is that these big manufacturers, Schwann and ConAgra and the rest of the giant deliverers of school food, have a lot of profit from school lunches.
Huge amounts.
Because they are taking advantage of cheap dairy products as a result of the corn subsidies that Congress continues to vote in. They get an opportunity to use the pink paste. And if anybody hasn't ever seen the pink paste, they need to Google that to see what these chicken nuggets and other products are made out of. The quality of the hamburger and the quality of the ground chicken in a lot of the school lunches, once you find out how it's processed, you'll lose your lunch. Because when you have to wash meat with ammonia in order to kill the bacteria on it and then put sugar and spices and other things back into it to mask the bitter taste of ammonia, that's the kind of things you want your kids to grow up on.
Very tasty food-like substances.
Very tasty food-like substances. And so, you know, Congress was wrong to back these new rules that are proposed by the Agriculture Department. There was an opportunity for the first time in 15 years to really make a dent in this and really fall in line with President Obama's effort to end childhood hunger. You know, when I realize...
How about just fall in line with rational thinking?
Yeah, but when I realize there's 1,000 kids that go to bed hungry here in rich Sarasota County, you know, every night, that's the 1,000 kids that we know about.
Right.
You know, reading Sunday's paper and discovering we have 9,000 homeless people living in the woods between Venice and Osprey was a pretty shocking statistic.
Yes.
9,000?
That's huge.
People. And so, you know, who needs leafy greens and carrots when pizza and french fries will do? And so,
the problem is they won't do. That's the problem here. Those are not foods. They won't do. They don't sustain our brains. They don't sustain our bodies. how can we continue this ludicrous, ridiculous support of a system that doesn't work?
Well, I think one of the things that we're doing here, Dr. Harvey, is trying to create awareness among our listeners.
Exactly.
That if we don't take care of our kids and we leave that job to Schwann and ConAgra and the rest of those companies that are getting huge profitability from selling pink paste and, you know, pizza, that we're going to lose out, and we're going to lose out in more ways than just increasing the debt ceiling as a result of medical expenses. When we look at the possibility that one out of three children that is currently obese or overweight has greatly increased their risk of diabetes.
Huge increase in the risk. It's just unfathomable. The kids that are coming up with diabetes today in adolescence is three times what it was 20 years ago, or four times. This is going to cause heart disease, dementia, and illnesses that are going to impair these kids many years before their parents would be impaired by the same problem, because it would be onset in adult years. And that we used to call type 2 diabetes, the insulin-resistant diabetes that comes as a result of obesity, adult-onset diabetes. Well, now we're seeing it in children. It's extremely frightening to see this demographic shift in disease. And your listeners are fabulous, and they're motivated, and they're here because they want this information. But then there's the rest of the country, the people in the middle of the red states that have the highest obesity epidemic, down in the deep south in Texas, Missouri, Mississippi, Alabama,
South Carolina.
They're not getting this information yet. Hopefully, more motivated people that are listening to this program can get it out there. Maybe we can get the kids trained to go into the schools and do poster contests to get it changed.
But the ridiculous posture is this: I'm not letting the government tell me what to eat. You know, you can't tax my soda pop.
Right.
You know,
well, only reason that argument's coming out there is the same reason that the Tea Party argument's coming out there, is that big business is sending out messages and organizing groups that are fighting for their causes under a different guise. You know, the freedom guise of not being able to tax my soda pop is Coca-Cola paying an activist group to get them to say that, as far as I'm concerned, because Coca-Cola doesn't want to lose their market.
Well, when we look at childhood obesity and the shape of things to come, we want to realize that this started in the early 70s. That was when average weight was starting to increase. But, you know, when we think about the 1970s, only 10% of kids were overweight or obese in the 1970s. We're up to 30% plus at this point. So if one in three children and adolescents is overweight or obese, and one in two in some minority groups,
yes,
then what we're looking at is the emergence of very serious weight-related problems. And that's what's happening now. We're in the second phase of this increasing of the girth of America. And it's not just a matter of the type 2 diabetes showing up in adolescence, even though it's increased by a factor of more than 10.
Yes.
10 times more kids have diabetes than did 20 years ago. But even the ones that don't have diabetes, we're showing up with fatty liver. And fatty liver is showing up in one out of three obese kids. Well, doctor, what happens when a child has fatty liver?
Well, that's the first step on the road to cirrhosis. But it's also an indication that the body's not able to handle the fats and the sugar. And from there, we see degeneration in other systems. You get cardiovascular problems, high blood pressure,
kidney failure,
trouble with thinking, difficulty with even psychosocial changes. Because of the trouble with thinking, you can get behavioral changes. Eating disorders come out of it because people get addicted to it. You can get anxiety and poor self-esteem and depression from all this.
Well, that's why obese children tend to be socially isolated and have higher rates of anxiety and depression than the population at large.
Right.
When they reach adulthood, they are much less likely than their thinner counterparts to complete college.
Yes,
lower. And they're much more likely to live in poverty.
Yes.
So it isn't just a matter of the fact that mom is driving the kid into the fast food restaurant and thinking, oh, gee, I wonder what age I can get Johnny's leg amputated. I am so forward to having little Betty's toes cut off.
Yes.
You know, I can't imagine a parent in the world who says, I really want to have a sick child.
Right.
I really want to have a kid on dialysis.
Right.
I really want to have a child have a heart attack. We have 11-year-olds having heart attacks.
Yes. I can't think of a parent that would want that either, but it's happening across the country now.
So when we talk about pediatric obesity, shortening the life expectancy here in the United States by about 5 years, and people go, oh, well, 5 years, you know.
What's that?
That's not really a lot. The problem is the 40 years that happened before you die.
Yes.
At the point when you don't have a leg and you're on kidney dialysis and you're having
can't
to use insulin and you can't get out of the chair and all of that. So, you know, if we sound just a little bit hysterical about this, please believe me, we are a little bit hysterical about this. I am really alarmed. I am really alarmed because there is a healthcare crisis that is on the horizon, the likes of which nobody is talking about. And that is the fact that we are having these children enter the healthcare system for regular maintenance by the healthcare system at way earlier ages than happens normally. So, you know, I'm a member of the baby boomer generation, and we were a great big huge bundle of people. And right below us, meaning the younger generation, is a smaller population. So right now, the baby boomers are a great big huge population. There's lots of caregivers for the elderly. But when we as baby boomers become the elderly, we have way fewer individuals younger than us to take care of us.
And many of those are going to be so ill that they will need care themselves.
And that's it. They're entering the healthcare system at the same time. And, you know, I've read all sorts of statistics of how many doctors were going to be short. You know, 90,000 doctors by 2020 is the last set of numbers that I've seen, because so many physicians are already over 65 and retiring. And back in the early 90s, when they were trying to make medical schools more competitive, they actually limited enrollments.
Right.
And as a result of limiting enrollments, we have less doctors than we actually need at a time when more doctors will be necessary.
We're already in a shortage as far as I'm concerned. I did some calculations 5 years ago that showed that if every primary care doctor, and I included pediatricians and obstetrician gynecologists in the equation, when you add all of them up and you add up all of the available people in the country to do annual preventive evaluations or physical examinations on them and do an adequate job of 45 minutes to an hour so you can actually know something about the client, you would occupy at least 35 hours a week, every week, for every primary care doctor.
Doing nothing but
annual preventive evaluation so you could actually see what's going on with these people. So if that's the case, where's the room for acute care, hospital care, and everything else that needs to be done? There's just not enough doctors already to go around. We need,
and so that's why we're shoving this stuff down the line, and we're letting nurse practitioners and other individuals take off more of the responsibility of medical care that used to be only in the bailiwick of the physician.
Right, right. I think that we really need to push that too. I think we, if we could educate more nurse practitioners, because I think it's easier and faster to get them educated, especially since there's so many nurses out there. Even though we're in a nursing shortage, I'd rather divert them into primary care, but educate them in nutrition, educate them in wellness care, not illness care, so that they can help promote wellness, like a primary care doctor should be. Primary care doctor is a coordinator and should be a bit of a health coach, like I try to be, and help guide people to a better lifestyle so they can actually improve their function rather than just treating illness and trying to put down illness. I try to lift up the human being, and that's what we need as primary care intervention. The government should be looking at actually cutting off funding for specialty care because it's worthless, as not really totally worthless, but it is excessive, overconsumed, and in those areas causes more damage when it is overconsumed. So we need to really restrict specialty care and let primary care doctors actually direct referral and not allow people go direct to subspecialists for their care, because that way we'll rein in costs. And if we double the amount of primary care physicians, we can help educate people people on what to do right before you end up needing a specialist.
You got a great soapbox there, Dr. Harvey. There's no question about it. You know, are you telling me that spending $200,000 on grandma's last month of life is not a good use of
time
or money?
Let me say a word. Psychotic.
Right.
Let go. Granny's supposed to die. We all do that. Life ends with death. That's part of the cycle. It's a good thing. Granny gets to rest. One of my best friends and adopted mother, my painting teacher of years, died last week before Thanksgiving. And I was able to be at her bedside and hold her hand and be her advocate and look at the code team. That's the people that come in and rush to the rescue and put the tubes in and do all the work. I was able to look at them and say, no, it's time for her to go and say goodbye to her. And it was really hard because I was basically her only family present. And I didn't want to let go because I love her. But I did because it was the right thing to do. And that's what we all should do. We should look at that and have these things change in a better way. We can look at death as something that's good. It's part of our lives. We need to embrace it.
Yeah, that's a stopping point for a lot of people. I know that that's the case in my practice. But we have to ask ourselves, where is our money well spent? Is our money well spent trying to take this client who's already got her appointment to fly home and trying to keep her here for another day or week or month? Or are we better off trying to get a vegetable into a kid? And I'm going to vote for the vegetable into the kid.
Spend that money in the right spot.
And so let's talk about what parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, neighborhood members can do. The first thing that I want to tell people to do is stop making food a reward. If you're a good girl, you get an ice cream. If you clean your room, you get a piece of cake. Stop making food a reward. You want to have a reward? Give them a Tonka toy, you know, give them a trip to the park, go out in the yard and play ball with them. But the idea is take food away as a reward. You
yes.
develop a psychology around that that is very detrimental. There's no question about it. The second thing is you got to realize in order to feed your kid well, you've got to be in the kitchen. You can't do it by pulling into a drive-through. So as long as you've made food too low on the priority list of things that you have to get done, oh, I'm too busy. That's what I hear from everybody. I'm too busy to cook dinner.
Right.
And yet, I can throw dinner together in 20 minutes because my dinner is based on the fact that I have a pantry.
Yes.
And the nature of the quality ingredients in that pantry is I can always put together a plate that's a fourth protein and a fourth starch and two-fourths non-starchy. I did it last night with the turkey sandwich. It had lettuce and tomato and sprouts on it. I made a carrot salad as a side salad. And so the idea is that I got those vegetables on the plate. My husband and I went out to dinner on Wednesday night, the day before Thanksgiving, at a new restaurant here in Sarasota, and both of us realized as we read the menu, there just wasn't enough vegetables on the list. The food was excellent. The service was good. The music was fabulous. But the thing is, it isn't a place that I could frequent because I couldn't even get a side of slaw with my grouper sandwich.
Wow.
So vegetables, vegetables, vegetables. Did I mention vegetables? Did I mention vegetables that aren't potatoes?
Vegetables.
And so how are we going to get vegetables into these kids, Dr. Harvey?
In all kinds of creative ways, I suppose, because it's going to take that, because kids are trained to eat these other things that don't necessarily give them the nutrition, but kind of taste better, because the big companies have spent millions and millions and billions of dollars on food science to get these things to taste addictive. So the kids will continue to ask for them.
Well, high salt, high sugar, high fat makes anything deeply yummy.
Right.
And so let's look at the fact that ranch dressing is the single most popular dressing for every child that I've ever met thus far. And so when you take one of those, plastic containers that has the sections and you put into it the carrots and the celery and the snow peas and the radishes and the jicama and the broccoli tops and all that, and you put that little dish of ranch dressing in the middle of it and you leave it out so that kids can snack on it. A lot of parents will say to me, well, Eve, I gave little Bobby broccoli and little Bobby didn't eat the broccoli. And so I tried it again and he didn't eat it the second time. And then I tried it a third time and, you know, what I know is little Bobby doesn't like broccoli. What I have to tell all parents is it takes about 13 exposures of a food in order to get a child to eat the food. So if you only put out the broccoli three times and Bobby said no three times, you still got a shot.
Yep.
So just making it available is the very first thing that we need to do.
And yeah, that's really it. Make it available, because once it's in the person's awareness, they can begin to think about it and think about it again. If we put these foods repeatedly in front of, I did with my kids, there was always a vegetable exactly like your plates. We filled it up, and if they didn't like the red cabbage, they at least had one taste of it.
Right.
And then they moved on.
The one bite rule.
Yes. And so just doing that one bite rule and exposing them, turn my kids into super omnivores. There's not a thing I know that they won't eat except for things that are kind of toxic, like highly processed foods. They won't touch them because they think they taste terrible because they like whole food.
Well, that's it. When people say, oh, those things don't have flavor, it's because you've been eating things that are artificially supercharged.
Right.
With flavors.
Yeah. A nacho chip has 32, 45 ingredients on it that are artificial and designed to stimulate your taste buds so that you get addicted to the flavor.
And so as we look toward the holidays, one of the things that happens during the holidays is we give ourselves more liberty for more cookies and cakes and candies and goodies. And now we have to ask the question, who are we helping? who are we doing that for? You know, are you doing it to support Monsanto? I mean, really? And please understand, I'm not an aesthetic by any stretch of the imagination. I'm one of those people that thinks that a day should not go by without dessert. I eat dessert every night. And so the nature of it is you plan it as part of the calories for the day, as part of the nutrients for the day.
Yes, but unlike the current advertising scenario, you don't have a 10 o'clock in the morning snack of a Snickers bar and a Red Bull for energy.
Uh-huh.
You don't do that. So when you don't do those stupid things and you actually plan your calories around having a sweet treat at the end of a meal, that's brilliant because it's combined with the meal. You don't get a huge glycemic index and you do get your reward, even though you're not supposed to use food as a reward. Everybody likes a sweet treat. The tongue just really enjoys it. It makes you smile. You get a little dopamine rush. Yeah. So it's a good thing to have it. And that's the way I tell my patients to survive this holiday season. Plan it. Think about it. Look at what's available of all those treats that come to your business place, because they're going to come. And look at them and evaluate and say, which one of these things is worth it today? And pick one and say, okay, I'm going to have this one treat after lunch or whatever, because everybody else is in there munching all the things. Have one treat.
Well, and just remember that taking your grandbaby to the ice cream parlor as your outing may not be the smartest habit to establish.
Yes.
And so when we start looking for other activities, kids want our time. They want our attention. They don't just want our trip to the ice cream store.
It's so true. Even as they age. I dragged my son. I got him in the car at like 5:40 last night, and we drove to the beach to see the sunset with Moon and Venus together, and it was lovely. We had a great time. There was no ice cream involved. We just had a nice time on the beach.
Right, and looking at Moon and Venus last night was pretty spectacular.
Super.
No doubt about it. Dr. Fred Harvey, internist, gerontologist, member of the American Board of Holistic Physicians, and the guest here on No Nonsense Nutrition, usually on the third Monday of every month. Dr. Harvey, thank you so much again for being our guest.
And thank you for having me.
And thank you for helping people learn to take better care of their kids. All you holistic moms that are out there, all of you breastfeeding moms that are out there that are really trying to do a better job, boy, I tip my hat to you, because you are the ones that are making a difference every time you serve little Bobby broccoli.